We'll hear arguments first this morning in South Carolina against Secretary Regan. Mr. Sinclair, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please this court. South Carolina this morning responds to the leave granted by this court to argue that this court take original jurisdiction to dispose of the case which it seeks to bring against the Secretary of the Treasury. Since its inception, South Carolina has been joined by perhaps some 27 states, and for that reason, we move this court, before this court, the court granted permission to divide argument, and I have thus will yield 10 minutes of my argument to the Assistant Attorney General from Texas. She will stress the financial burdens that result to the states on account of this provision in the law. The Solicitor General has suggested in his brief, I think it was in a footnote, that since this case so clearly lacks merit, that the court dismiss and grant him the relief. I think that necessitates comment on the true issues that are involved here. This case really has a historic background. In 1894, Congress enacted an income tax law, which was broad and wide-sweeping. It included a provision taxing the interest on notes and bonds of whatever nature, except those bonds of the United States, which by the terms of their issuance were exempt from taxation. That produced the famous litigation of Pollock against Farmers Loan and Trust Company, which was twice heard by this court. At all times, it was unanimous that the very nature of the federal system prevented the imposition of a tax on the interest on state bonds. However, because of its holding with respect to the lack of power to impose an excise tax on interest and dividends and rents, the law was declared, which had been declared unconstitutional by 5-4 in Pollock, really resulted in the adoption of the 16th Amendment. Now, from the time of Pollock until 1982, with the enactment of TEFRA, Congress had conceded, although it was done originally by Mr. Cordell Hull as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee in 1913, the fact that interest on state bonds was immune from taxation. But in TEFRA, we see a direct challenge, and meanwhile, the court, while never having precisely this question before it, repeatedly said time after time that the doctrine of reciprocal immunity, which was essential to the federal system, resulted in the freedom from taxation of interest on state bonds. All of that lasted until 1982, when TEFRA challenges both the meaning of the 16th Amendment, as has been announced by this court, although I suppose those pronouncements are dicta. They were pronounced so many times that they seem to work themselves into the body of and tradition of the law. And they have further challenged the doctrine, must further argue that the 16th Amendment permits this tax. We don't think it does. The Solicitor General has urged that this court should not take jurisdiction of this case despite the fact that the second clause of the second section of Article 3 of the Constitution specifically grants to this court original jurisdiction in actions which involve a state and a citizen of another state. What we're doing here, of course, is to seek an injunction against the Secretary of the Treasurer in the traditional fashion of enjoining an officer of the United States from performing, acting under an unconstitutional statute and thus performing an illegal act. I think Marbury against Madison got to this court in the same way.
Mr. Sinclair, could I ask you one question?
Sure.
I guess you left the merits and you're going to the Injunction Act. In your view, would Congress have the power to pass a statute that said all bonds traded in the interstate market must be in registered form, including those issued by a state, without any taxation as a penalty?
I don't think they do. I think that's an invasion of the state's right. I think maybe in that case, you might get yourself, your determination might rest on a balancing of equities as has been traditional, where the Commerce Clause is involved, whereas here, where the Taxation Clause's power is involved, what you really have here is a question of reciprocal immunity, one that really goes to the very nature of the federal system.
But that would be a lesser burden or a greater burden on the state than the one they have now.
I think we'd
you
meet,
can avoid
I think
the tax by selling.
I think we'd meet both burdens, sir.
You do.
I think we can meet both burdens and show you. For instance, we, South Carolina, sold $65 million of bonds on September 13, which we will deliver in New York next week. We normally pay for paying agent services on an issue of $65 million. I think we've had some before, and we figured to be about $85,000. The cost of paying issuing registered bonds, now they're not so terribly expensive, but the cost of arranging for their transfers and arranging for the checks to go out, we have an estimate from the Morgan Bank, which is our fiscal agent and bond registrar, that the cost of this issue, which has an average life of 11 years and extends to 00, will be $385,000. South Carolina, which is an additional cost of $310,000. Now, it happens that South Carolina has approximately a debt of about $600 million. And the state treasurer has structured that debt on a short-term basis, so he will be able to come back to the trough more frequently. Well, if you just multiply, assuming it was $650 million, you'd really have added cost in the neighborhood of over $3 million. Now, that's a good deal of money.
But are you saying the federal government may not impose any regulation on the issuance of bonds that imposes any cost on the state?
Federal government, if we're going to have the traditional federal system, which was espoused really as far back as Weston against the city of Charleston, which they said at that time, that the doctrine of immunities springs from the very union of the states and the national government. I realize that you could also justify that as under the Supremacy Act, which I think several members of this court have made that statement. I have no quarrel with that. But certainly as far as the reciprocal immunity which is granted to the states, that results from the nature of the compact. There's no provision in the Constitution of the United States to that effect. As a matter of fact, the case, of course, went through the South Carolina Constitutional Court, and by a 4-3 decision, the majority said there's nothing in the Constitution of the United States which says we can't do this. The dissenting judges said the very nature of the system makes it impossible for the state to tax the obligation of the federal government, because to do so, and I thought the interest rate comment was marvelous, even though Congress provide that the money be let at 10%, if states can tax it, it'll be Congress, the Treasury of the United States will be powerless to borrow. And that's the burden takes place, according to Chief Justice Marshall. The very existence of it creates a burden on the contract which has a sensible interest impact on the interest of the influence on the contract itself. And furthermore, when one government can control the provisions, the actions of another government, then you obviously have that type of governmental interference, which I personally believe the federal system precludes.
Of course, the doctrine of intergovernmental immunity kind of reached a high point in the 1870s or 1880s, and then some of this court's cases in the 30s rather drastically cut back on this.
I think you've got good distinctions. Take, for instance, the most famous of all the people who are really affected by this case, Chief Justice Hughes, who in Wilcox against Bunn reaffirms and points out that the difference between imposing a tax on capital gains and on the interest on bonds is that one transaction, the transaction between the state and its lender, has been finished, and that's a totally new transaction which results in part from the acumen of the person who bought the bonds.
And, did that case involve intergovernmental immunities?
He quotes Weston and reaffirms everything that I've said. And, of course, Governor Hughes started the great debate with his message to the General Assembly of New York in January of 1910. And that produced the language of the 16th Amendment came into focus. And there was this great debate, which was joined in by Senator Borah, by Senator Elihu Root, and President Taft himself. And on the basis of the apparent success in persuading the public, the 16th Amendment was adopted. Hughes twice took a curtain call on the scene. He was a justice in the case of Bruchab against Union Pacific, the first case following the adoption of the 16th Amendment, which held that it merely sought to accomplish that which Pollock denied, the right to tax rents, interest, and income. Then Hughes, of course, writing Wilcox against Bunn as Chief Justice, reaffirms all of that.
What about federal taxation of the salaries of state employees?
Well, there the tax is paid by the individual employee. It's a non-discriminatory tax so widespread that it does not affect this honorable court has held that it does not affect.
I suppose it might increase the state's cost of its labor force.
I think it probably might, but that's an incidental cost that this court saw fit to declare.
Suppose the government, instead of speaking about registered bonds, just subjected to income taxation all of the interest on all state bonds.
Well, if you do that.
And, of course, that tax would be paid by the holders of the bond.
Let me suggest to you some of the tax is paid by the state itself. The fact that there can be a tax, it makes the state pay the tax. Now, when we sold these bonds, we had no choice of issuing coupon bonds. That would have been ridiculous. We couldn't get a market on that. We obviously had to sell fully registered bonds. Now, I did provide in the proceedings that if this litigation resulted the way I hope it would, that we might later issue coupon bonds. But from a practical standpoint, we issued bonds. I think the difference in cost to the state of South Carolina on the $65 million issue, we paid 8.1. I think it would run to perhaps 11 point. I'm comparing South Carolina's AAA credit and IBM's AAA credit. IBM obviously more.
So you think that South Carolina is paying an increased interest to the equivalent of the tax burden on the holder?
Oh, yes. We'd pay it. We'd obviously pay it. No question about it. The market would demand otherwise. People don't buy state bonds. They look for the net interest cost. That's all very carefully calculated. Now, this TEFRA also put in a provision which limited the deduction that banks might take for borrowed money, and I suppose all bank money is borrowed money, when they came to calculate their income tax on the including 15% of the tax-exempt interest. Now, that's not challenged because I think the court could levy a tax without any, the Congress could levy a tax without any exemptions. I think that's a totally different situation. But immediately after that 15% went into effect, the rates were adjusted by the major banks so that they ended up by the issue of paying that additional tax. That's inevitable. There's no possible way that the issue can escape the tax. But I think even worse, the consequences of this, are the consequences of the Congress taking over the local affairs of government.
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. An immeasurable and heavy financial burden has been put on the key sovereign operations of the states by the enactment of this particular section of TEFRA against a dubious benefit to Treasury in enforcing the prevention of tax evasion. Moreover, the Solicitor General has suggested in his brief the tax exemption of municipal bonds as a matter of constitutional right is a debatable proposition. My portion of this argument will try to show the financial consequences of the effects of those two propositions and why this appeal to the Court's original jurisdiction is necessary for the protection of the states.
Ms. Voss, there are many things the federal government does by way of congressional or regulatory requirements that end up costing states a lot of money. So how does the financial burden alone support your argument?
This particular financial burden goes to a basic premise in the Constitution of federalism, something which has been guaranteed to the states since constitutional law started. You can trace it back to McCulloch versus Maryland if you want to. But each day this law is in effect, in Texas alone, you have at least one issuer going to market, paying somewhere between $5,000 and $14,000 in registrar fees that they didn't have to pay before a year. Now you're talking, if each one of 3,395 Texas issuers goes to market one time, about $17 million annually in additional registrar costs. These are costs that these issuers did not have to bear before. There are about 47,000 municipal issuers in this country. And those registrar costs hit the little issuers a lot harder than they hit the big issuers. One of the big guys like the University of Texas that doesn't really usually go to market for less than $20 million at a time, it's going to pay lower registrar fees than some little school district that issues can barely issue on its tax base maybe $1 million to renovate a 60-year-old schoolhouse. And those figures only represent the registrar fees. Additional attorney's fees are extra. Additional costs of documentation are extra. Registrar fees do not even include the postage for mailing out the interest
check. And the income from the oil wells.
Beg pardon?
And the income from the oil wells that the University of Texas enjoys.
Well, that's permanent university fund money. But we're not just talking about a financial burden alone. It's a financial burden that's going to help cripple the ability of issuers to perform their governmental functions. You're talking about a jail. As many of you probably know, in Texas, probably has five inmates to a cell that was meant to hold two and is under federal court order to improve conditions.
General Voss, could I ask you, supposing the federal government were to have regulations as the kind of disclosures a borrower has to make when it issues bonds, and they say you have to file a registration statement and tell whether you're financially solvent and all that sort of thing, which is costly. You have to hire accountants to prepare the statement. Could they require a state issuer to comply with rules of that kind, do you think?
As a matter of marketing bonds, state issuers presently comply with those sorts of requirements.
No, but assume, but could the federal government compel them to? I say, could they change those to make them more burdensome without violating
that particular issue has never been challenged as to its constitutionality. The states have been complying with it as a marketing matter. And I have serious questions as to its constitutionality.
Seems to me your argument would apply to that as well, that you're basically arguing that there's no power in the federal government to impose any burden whatsoever upon a state issuing bonds, which is a rather extreme position. But that is your position, I think.
Yes, sir. When you have something like the jail renovations, which are required to be done, and there's no money to do them because you had to replace a school that burnt down, and you've had increased cost of issuance on those bonds, probably the school burnt down because you knew you needed a firehouse over there, but you didn't have money for that because you had more cost of issuance on the sewage treatment plant. You're talking about serious problems with that. And as to the removal of the income tax exemption altogether, you are going to foreclose many issuers from the marketplace completely. The only attraction that their paper has in the marketplace right now is that tax-exempt feature.
We don't have to decide that in this case, do we, whether or not the federal government has the power to tax the income from the municipal bond?
No, that is not before you, sir. South Carolina has made an appropriate call as the real party in interest to the jurisdiction of this court as constitutionally provided, and it is simply inconceivable that an act of Congress could deprive the state of that forum, particularly with the financial burden to our governmental functions that this law is creating. I submit that this is an appropriate case for this court's original jurisdiction.
Mr. Claiborne.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Let me say straight away, lest the contrary impression has been given by our concentration on jurisdictional obstacles to this court's entertaining the case, that we're not in the least shy in reaching the merits. If the court concludes, contrary to our submission, that the Anti-Injunction Act is not a barrier, we're not reluctant to meet South Carolina's constitutional challenge. And while this court is not required to hear the case, the Secretary is content that the merits be decided here. Indeed, we submit, as has been said, that the constitutionality of the statute is sufficiently clear that the court could properly dispose of the case at this stage on this motion for leave to file. After all, what is and all that is involved here is an indirect, is only indirect, requirement that all obligations which extend for more than a year, no matter by whom issued, whether by the United States, by corporations, by states and municipalities, if issued to the general public, shall be in registered form. Now, this is in no sense discriminatory. It is only the mildest intrusion on state sovereignty. It seems to us far less so than the requirements sustained, for instance, for withholding income tax from state employees.
What is the government's interest, Mr. Claiborne?
The Congress determined, on the basis of elaborate hearings and evidence before it, that bearer bonds were one common means, device for avoiding gift tax, estate tax, capital gains tax on the exchange of those bonds, that it was moreover a haven for illegally obtained monies, and finally, it's right to add that theft and interstate transportation of stolen securities is facilitated when bonds are in bearer rather than registered form. Those considerations, all of which bear on plain powers of Congress conferred by Article I, fully justify the federal interest in enacting this statute.
Of course, I'm old enough to remember when registered bonds were rather frequently encountered. They've disappeared over the years. Certainly, there can't be much federal government interest in getting to the tax as such.
Quite candidly, Justice Blackmun, this is not a revenue-raising measure. It has a revenue aspect. It is an exercise of the taxing power in that it is a necessary and proper means to attempt to diminish tax evasion and tax avoidance. In that sense, it's an exercise of the taxing power.
Well,
but the object of the exercise is not to raise additional taxes.
Except that the government's, the Congress retreat from the withholding of interest and dividends, it makes this argument sound rather hollow, doesn't it?
It may be that there is some tension between those two contradictory actions for Congress. But we are here defending that portion of the legislation which did pass, and which, to some degree at least, avoids what is otherwise determined to be a common way of avoiding, as I say, both gift and estate taxes and also capital gains taxes. Now, the burden imposed on the states as a result of this is surely less than the burden imposed by many other federal regulations, including the one I just mentioned, the requirement of withholding. And as to the costs, the additional costs imposed on the states, we have not attempted to produce counter-affidavits, but it's fair to surmise that there would be offsetting economies in the area of insurance and handling. And, of course, the statute does not require that the bonds, though issued in registered form, be issued through certificates.
Of course, if the burden is a factual matter, your suggestion that we ought to surmise that there would be offsetting benefits really doesn't dispense with the necessity of some sort of an inquiry. If there is a factual, if the factual question of burden should play a part in deciding the case.
Quite so, Justice Rehnquist, though I take Justice O'Connor's point that the exact degree of the burden is not constitutionally relevant so long as there is a plain exercise of the power of Congress under Article I, and even accepting the allegations of the plaintiff states, no impermissible burden imposed on the power of the state of South Carolina or any other to raise revenues. This is simply a question of what form those revenues shall be raised in. It is not an attempt to tax the interest on all state and municipal bonds, and of course it's in no sense a prohibition on, or an inhibition on the state's power to raise monies. We would answer Justice Stevens's question whether, if this statute were not in the form of a tax, but was simply a uniform requirement imposed on all issuers of all obligations of a certain character, that they be in registered form, we would defend that statute in the same way that we do this one.
Mr. Claiborne, may I ask if our decision is to grant the motion to leave to file. Would it be necessary to appoint a special master?
We would say not, and we would say not for the reasons I've suggested in invoking Justice O'Connor's comment. It may be that the court will feel that the degree of the burden, as Justice Rehnquist suggests, is a matter which, and the question whether there are indeed offsetting economies, is one that appropriately requires the hearing of evidence in which event a master...
But that would be the only inquiry that needs to be...
As I see it, Justice Brennan, that is the only potential question that a master might be able to take evidence and help this court toward its...
Mr. Claiborne, does the federal government have the authority to withdraw altogether the tax exemption on income from state and municipal bonds?
Justice Powell, we would say yes, but we...
The government does have the authority.
We so allege.
Yes.
We do not think it's necessary for the court to reach that question in this case.
But is there a limiting principle? And if so, where is it?
Well, if contrary to our position, the United States cannot deny exemption to state and municipal obligations altogether, then there must be a limit. We would say that this doesn't approach that limit, since it doesn't deny the exemption to all registered bonds, and merely requires that in order to earn the exemption, the bonds be issued in that form.
But that's
which is a traditional form. It's not a an exceptional requirement.
Could the federal government do what it's done to the rest of the public, and that is start with a very low income tax on government issued on state and municipal securities and gradually move it up?
I haven't an opportunity to consider that question. I would have supposed that the power to tax, when abused, amounts to destroying the state's power to raise revenue. But as this court has said, we sit here to assure that that limit is not reached. What that limit
is. The power to tax is not limited by the 10th Amendment.
The power to tax may be limited, but it's not eliminated by the 10th Amendment.
Mr. Claiborne, you don't concede that this is a tax on the state, do you? This is a tax on the bond.
No, it's a tax on the bond interest. I'm assuming, for the purpose of answering Justice Powell, that the state's immunity does run to the bondholder. Otherwise, there is no question of a limitation. Now, we have invoked jurisdictional barriers to this court's entertaining the case, and we've done so because we deemed it our duty to bring to the court's attention what seemed to us plain obstacles to reaching the merits in this case. The principle that no court should decide that which it lacks jurisdiction to decide, or that it ought not decide it prematurely, is a principle of more importance than the result in any given case. It's important for the maintenance of the court system. And in this instance, it's important for the government's interest. It's familiar that few things are more important, more salutary to our tax system than the rule embodied in statute for over 100 years that no suit will lie to enjoin the collection of taxes. And indeed, most states, I don't know whether it be true or not with respect to South Carolina and Texas, but it is the general rule in most states that they have a like rule with respect to the enjoining of the collection of their own taxes.
Mr. Claiborne, is your position about the power of Congress to limit the court's jurisdiction somewhat contrary to Marbury versus Madison?
We, Justice O'Connor, do not view it as a contradiction with the dictum in Marbury versus Madison, because it seems to us that this is simply a procedural limitation on when this court, as any other court, may entertain an action of this kind. It is common ground, I take it, that a statute of limitations governs this court in the exercise of its original jurisdiction as it governs every other court.
Can Congress limit the remedies that this court can provide in the exercise of its jurisdiction, its original jurisdiction?
We would say yes, Justice O'Connor, that at least so long as the rule is uniform and non-discriminatory against this court, and it's simply a rule of procedure which announces when an injunction is appropriate, for instance.
By that argument, can Congress limit the term in which this court can sit or establish filing fees that would determine what cases could be taken?
Not what cases could be taken in terms of classes of cases. My impression is that the Congress does set the term of this court by statute. But I assume that there are limits there. I don't suppose that the Congress could say this court shall not sit for 2 years. I assume, on the other hand, that it is permissible, as is present law, that the Congress may say that the court shall begin its new term on the first Monday in October.
If you were correct on the jurisdictional point, is there any way at all that South Carolina could get a hearing on its question in any court?
It is not we who are preventing South Carolina from testing the issue by issuing a bearer bonds, albeit it may be that those bonds would have to be issued in order to find purchasers at an abnormally high rate of interest. But if they wish to press the matter, that is obviously available way in which it can be done, and it needn't be a large issue.
And then the purchaser himself would have to file a suit, not South Carolina.
Indeed, but there's no bar to the purchasers either challenging the deficiency in the tax court if he has failed to pay his interest on that issue of the bonds he holds, or by refund suit in the district court or the claims court. But whether or not there will, at the end of the day, as a practical matter, be an occasion to test the constitutionality of this statute is no reason why, if no other court can presently entertain this suit, this court ought to be driven to take jurisdiction. That is, it seems to us, entirely backwards. Congress has, in the interest of sparing this court's burdened docket, given concurrent jurisdiction in a case of this kind to the district courts. And what South Carolina would suggest is that because the anti-injunction statute bars a district court from entertaining the suit, it ought to be bounced back to this court, the court of all courts, which ought to be less hospitable to litigation than the district courts, whose primary role is to entertain.
Well, that goes to the proper use of the discretion of this court, whether to accept it or not, don't you think? You're arguing instead that this court cannot accept it.
Justice O'Connor, I argue both. I say that the legislative bar imposed by the Anti-Injunction Act just like the legislative bar imposed by a statute of limitations, just like the legislative bar imposed by the Norris-LaGuardia Act, which in terms apply to all the courts of the United States, of which this is one, does apply here, and hence, if it prevents the district court from hearing the case, likewise prevents this court from doing so. This court, however, may choose not to determine that issue and may, as a matter of its own discretion, with an eye to the congressional policy, determine that it is inappropriate for this court to do the business which other courts have been prevented from doing in obedience to a legislative policy of such long standing and with such obvious salutary reasons behind it. And therefore, as a matter of discretion, if not as a matter of necessity, this court ought to decline to entertain the action.
Mr. Claiborne, have you considered the case of Allen against the Regents of the University of Georgia in connection with your argument, whether that isn't a response that you ought to deal with?
Justice Stevens, I am aware of that case, and it is very relevant to the present case. I take it, however, that the way in which it was dealt with by this Court's opinion in the Bob Jones case indicates that, in the Court's view, it is no longer good law, any more than the case on which it was based, was it Beechnut case, which had, in the Court's terms, eroded, if not scuttled, the Anti-Injunction Act. In Allen, which was a 5-3 decision on this point, the court felt constrained to allow, though not as an original suit, to concede that the Anti-Injunction Action there did not bar a suit to challenge the requirement that the university collect amusement tax on the tickets sold at football games. And that may be very comparable to this case. But it does seem to us that that was a circumvention of the Anti-Injunction statute. And more importantly, it seems to us that the court has so treated it in its now current opinion in Bob Jones University versus Simon, and indeed in the companion case. The argument the other way was put as eloquently as could be in the Americans United case by the dissenting opinion of Justice Blackmun. But that view did not prevail, and it seems to us that that view is precisely the view that had been embraced by the court in the Allen case. Let me say one final thing with respect to the question of Marbury versus Madison and our argument seeming in contradiction with it. Marbury versus Madison, of course, holds that that the Congress cannot add to the court's original jurisdiction, and indeed an argument could be made that therefore invoking the Declaratory Judgment Act here would be adding to the jurisdiction of this court in some sense. We would not make that argument, and in the same vein, we would not here say that the Anti-Injunction Action, a statute, takes away from the court's jurisdiction. It simply instructs all courts of the United States when they may hear a controversy, not what controversies they may hear. And it cannot be different, whether it's the rule is that it's too late to hear it, as in the case of the statute of limitations.
How could the court ever hear on appeal a case to which South Carolina was a party in connection with this tax, if we can't hear it here?
There could be no such case in which South Carolina was the plaintiff, but that is often true. The reason South Carolina...
You're then saying that South Carolina can never have an adjudication in this court about that, at its instance.
With respect to this particular issue, I think that's so. South Carolina, of course, needn't sit entirely on the sidelines when the taxpayer files his refund suit.
If a taxpayer ever does, why would a taxpayer? He's going to be getting higher interest rates. What's he got at stake?
Well, he would just as soon pocket all of that higher interest rate rather than pay half of it to the Treasury.
Well, I know, but he has to hire a lawyer, and he's not getting any less out of his bonds than he ever did. Only South Carolina is getting less out of its bonds.
It may be, and this is precisely the argument that Justice Blackmun made in Americans United, that such a suit might never come about because the organization, among other things, might change its activity, or because the contributor wouldn't find it worthwhile hiring a lawyer and going through the costs and delays of filing a suit, to which the court said, that is no reason to break the rule of the anti-injunction statute.
Well, the state is a party here that wasn't involved in the Bob Jones case.
I appreciate that the state has a claim, but that the state is different from an ordinary party. Of course, with respect to ordinary taxpayers, it must happen every day that people who would engage in a certain commercial transaction if they were assured of the tax consequences, but not being able to obtain a declaration from a court in advance and not being able to obtain a favorable revenue ruling, simply demur and do not engage in that transaction, and the matter is never tested judicially. That is no reason to allow an advance declaratory or injunctive action. And it seems to us the same reasoning must apply in this case. After all, the original jurisdiction of this court was afforded to states in order to avail them of a forum which was thought equal to their sovereign dignity. But it was not a forum that was meant to be more open or more hospitable than the other forum equally available to
the state. Is there now a withholding on interest on bonds in the issued by private issuers?
My impression is that that statute was repealed and is not presently the law.
So that South Carolina, if it would be under no obligation now to file any withholding statements or to report to the government how much interest it was paying to people.
I think not. One final thing on that score: the most recent amicus brief filed, and I'm not confident whether the court has granted me to file it, but suggests that the alternative to this statute is a requirement that the issuer's paying agent report to whom the bearer bonds have been delivered, keep records of any payments of interest, and thereby furnish a trail for the Federal Revenue Offices to satisfy themselves that there's been no attempted avoidance or evasion of tax. I'm frankly baffled what is different about conceding that those requirements would be proper and challenging this more straightforward requirement that the bonds be issued in registered form ab initio. We submit that the court ought not grant leave to file because, as a matter of the anti-injunction statute applicable here as elsewhere, the court cannot entertain the suit.
It
should not, if it can.
You finish your sentence.
But that if the merits are appropriately reached, they are sufficiently clear that the suit should be dismissed at this stage.
Mr. Claiborne, I just wanted to go back for a moment to the Allen case again and be sure I understand your submission, because as I glance again at the opinion, the court did in that case rely to some extent on the fact that you had a state interest involved, that the University of Georgia, the Board of Regents of the University of Georgia, was speaking on behalf of the state. And to the extent that you rely on Bob Jones as in effect repudiating the rationale of that case, it really couldn't repudiate that aspect of the case. And so maybe it at least survives when the person seeking to bring the litigation is a state as opposed to a private university or something like that.
Well, I'm perhaps missed the passage Your Honor refers to in the Allen case. I had not appreciated that the court felt that because it was a state rather than an ordinary taxpayer, the anti-injunction statute prohibition ought to be relaxed.
But that was the fact, though, in the case.
It was, indeed.
And I may read too much into it. It isn't as clear as it might be. I'm not suggesting you misread it. But that is really your response to the case, is almost exclusively that Bob Jones has undermined it.
Well, but that case was wrongly decided, as Bob Jones indicates.
Yeah, the reasoning of Allen's is totally inconsistent with the reasoning of Bob Jones.
Well, exactly so, Justice Rehnquist. I cannot reconcile them, and I don't think this Court attempted to do so in Simon, but at least the Court clearly repudiated the case on which Allen is in turn relying, and mentioned Allen as simply following in that erroneous view, and while the case is not in terms overruled, I take it its holding has been effectively eroded.
Did the chief do that?
I guess he did.
Do you have anything further?
If it please, Mr. Chief Justice, if it please the court, I would like to suggest to the court the consequences of permitting the national government to inject itself into the issuance of state bonds. And I'm talking about state bonds issued for state purposes. I'm not talking about industrial revenue or those type of bonds. If the Congress can tell South Carolina it's got to issue revenue bonds, then it can tell South Carolina that it can only issue bonds of a certain kind, or if it issues those bonds, it must issue a different kind of bonds. You're really going to move the seat of government from the local capitals to Washington, because if you just look at the Internal Revenue Act, Section 103 was about two lines until they started in this sort of esoteric type of borrowing. And you now find 15 pages and hundreds of pages of regulations. Well, that's what you're going to have if you once let the camel put his nose under the tent and tell states when they should or should not issue bonds or how they should issue bonds. And I'm talking about state bonds for state public purposes, Your Honor.
Mr. Sinclair, may I ask, I don't think you've suggested the response to the government's argument that the Tax Injunction Act bars this court's jurisdiction of the suit.
Excuse me, sir?
I don't think you've addressed the government's argument, have you, that the Tax Injunction Act bars this court's jurisdiction of this suit?
Well, in the first place, Your Honor, I think that this case involves something a great deal more than a tax. This is referred to in the Joint Committee reports as a sanction, not a tax. this provision. What this case, this is a matter where this court should take jurisdiction, because this case really involves the right of the national government to impose its will upon the government of the states. It's a fundamental question. It also, he has boldly announced, I didn't think he was going to boldly announce, I thought he was trying to get away from it, that the 16th Amendment permits the federal government to tax state bonds, which overrules certainly the dicta of this court for 60 years.
Mr. Sinclair, if we do grant your motion for leave to file, should we appoint a special master?
Not at all, sir. The facts are here. The facts are here. The basic question is intrusion.
Well, what if we agree with you? What should we do at this juncture? We haven't granted leave to file yet.
I think you ought to let us file our complaint.
Well, and then what?
Then invite further briefs and further argument, I would assume.
Oh, you mean you have some arguments on the merits to present you haven't presented now? Or?
I think there are a considerable number of arguments. I think this court would find itself interested in the history of the whole problem, because this case really goes.
But if you're going to do that, why wouldn't you want the opportunity to support some of your factual allegations about the burdens on the state, and maybe the federal government would want to.
I would have no objection.
Have
to
testimony
it.
With respect to. What kind of a basis there is for requiring registered bonds?
We would certainly have no objection to it, Your Honor. There happen to be about $500 billion of coupon bonds outstanding now that are not covered by this thing,
yes.
So that the result that the government seeks is not going to come about probably for a great many years.
I think I have my answer.
Mr. Sinclair, you have asked for a preliminary injunction, I thought.
I was denied that, Your Honor.
Oh, so that's out of the case.
I was denied that. I didn't know any method of appealing. I thought
well,
I should
like
have had
to
it.
You can renew the motion right now, I suppose.
You'll take it with or without a master. If we take jurisdiction, you don't care whether there's a master or not.
That's right, sir.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Russo.